Welcome back to the Clave Chronicles. I'm Rebecca Bodenheimer, and today's episode is a big departure for me because I know literally nothing about the topic, which is Cuban punk. I'm guessing a lot of my listeners aren't that familiar with it either, so we'll all be learning something new and going on a little journey today. Just a quick note, in case you didn't listen to last week's rerun episode, I'm going to be moving to a 2-episode-a-month format, as it's been hard for me to keep up with new episodes weekly in the past month or two. So I hope you'll continue to tune in and tell your friends about the podcast so I can keep putting it out. And thanks, as always, for your support. So my guest today is Carmen Torre Perez, who wrote her dissertation on underground music cultures in Cuba, specifically punk, at the University of Pennsylvania, which she just finished last year. Currently, she's a lecturer of Spanish in the Department of Romance Studies at Boston University. Welcome, Carmen.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm really pleased to be here.
Yeah, great. I thought we could start out kind of talking just a little bit about the political context in the earlier decades of the revolution and the ways rock and related genres were really denigrated and criminalized in the 1960s and 70s, as I assume this kind of had a big effect on the development of punk and just like how countercultural it has always been in Cuba.
Yeah, definitely. And that's kind of like the time frame that I used for my dissertation as well, because you need to know everything that happened before you can understand how punk comes to be in mm-hmm. Cuba. So, yeah, we have, ever since the triumph of the revolution, the relationship of the Cuban institutions with rock-related cultures and all like cultures of American, Anglo-American influence was complicated. Mm-hmm. So in we have this, Palabras a los Intelectuales in 1961 or 1963, I forget. But this was kind of like the first public discourse in which Fidel Castro referenced rock. He talked about it in a very pejorative way and associated it with being homosexual, which he also considered to be like a pejorative characteristic. So
That's like so bizarre. It's like he just took two things that he didn't like and just like put them together or something.
Yeah, totally. But I guess, well, it deviated from the idea of the new man, and it was people with long hair, with tight jeans or ripped clothes. So yeah, so all of that was considered gay and was considered non-revolutionary. And it wasn't officially banned, but it just like, it wasn't broadcast on radios, and it started to become pretty underground. People didn't like to be like publicly associated with listening to rock and stuff because they could get in trouble. And things got even worse when the UMAP were created. Rockers were also...
And those were the re-education camps?
Yes.
Yeah.
The re-education camps. So we were talking about the idea of the new man. And basically, if a rocker is not suitable to be like a revolutionary person, then they need to be re-educated. And especially, I know the queer community suffered a lot at the UMAP, at the re-education camps. And since rock was also associated with being gay, it was kind of like connected in that sense. And it was just an official persecution. And with time, it became just like more and more punished by the system until it was relegated to very, very underground and secretive channels of distribution.
Yeah. Now, was there actually any connection between like, were queer people like more involved in this scene? Like, was there an actual connection, or was it just like, oh, they have long hair and, you know, they don't fit into our ideal of, you know, the upstanding socialist citizen?
I would say there is a connection that would Proof would prove to be a connection be among scenes, but more in the late 80s, which was it had to do with HIV presence. That HIV presence was very, very heavy in the rock underground music community. And same was in other parts of the world, but it was also having a big impact in the gay community, in the queer community. So I would say that would be the most connecting point of all. Other than that, no, it was just like the authorities making that connection because of the aesthetic display of rockers.
Now there's this term that I've sometimes heard or read about called like the freakies. Was that the term that people use to describe themselves?
I don't know who if it came from an outsider or if they themselves created it, but they definitely at least adopted it and used it. And in the research I did, I came to see freakies as precursors of punk. Freakies kind of emerged in the 1980s, and it was the first big rock underground music community in the island, from what I've seen. There were hippies before and some other things, but it wasn't either it wasn't as big or there are just no records of it, so I haven't been able to read or learn about it, you know. So it all started with freakies in the 80s. It was just this new underground scene emerged, and it was, I guess, it was difficult to receive music influences that were rock related, so they couldn't get so specific that they would subdivide into metalheads and punks. You know, everything was freaky, and they listened to everything that sounded kind of rock, metal, punk. They did show a preference for more extreme sounding genres. So not just classic rock, but they were trying to listen to death metal or thrash metal, and punk obviously came that way as well. And they got their access to music through two ways mainly. One was through foreign radio stations, the ones that could get an antenna that could reach foreign frequencies. They would listen to what they were playing in their foreign radios. And they just like through the smuggling of cassette tapes at the time. And that's what people would just like listen to something, pass it on to the others and stuff. And that's how this community started to grow. They started to create their own bands and stuff. And so metal and punk wasn't as really divided, but towards the end of the decade, towards the end of the 80s, that's when extra sort of division starts to happen. And what I argue is that punk actually emerges in the early 90s, so after the collapse of the Soviet bloc. My theory is that punk needs, like, it necessitates a moment of big crisis in a place in order to emerge. So this was in England and the US, it was in the late 70s.
Like that was there, those were moments of economic crisis, and disaffectation of young people.
And in a lot of Latin America, that is throughout the 80s with the dictatorships or the end of the dictatorships, the incorporation of neoliberalism into their economies. And in Cuba, obviously, this happens in the 90s when the Soviet Union falls and the special period starts. So that created such an like an existential crisis for everyone that the first punk band started to play. It is difficult to pinpoint the exact year because things had been brewing for a while, and it's like late 80s, early 90s. But one thing that really affected this freaky scene and that kind of like marked the divide between metalheads and punks was the HIV epidemic. So a group of freakies decided to actually self-inject the HIV virus. And theories as to why this happened vary a lot, but I think they could vary from person to person because maybe if people had their different reasons. Some people said it was a rebellious way of committing suicide for one, for some. There's this famous freaky Papo Lavala who already passed away, and he said he expressed in an interview like when you have no more doors left to open, death is a door. So like they were aware that they would potentially die with this, but it was kind of like a rebellious way of doing it. It was a way of also protesting the system, because at this moment the government is trying to contain this epidemic, and just by purposefully choosing to contract HIV and spreading it, you're kind of like undermining their efforts, and in a way further undermining the idea of the new man, or what it is to be a good citizen and a good revolutionary person. Because first you are damaging your body with HIV, so you are not like an able-bodied, healthy person that will work and contribute to the society.
Yeah.
And also you are not allowed to work if you have HIV at this time. You will be
Yeah.
sent to a sanatorium where you will live for free. So you are abusing in a way the
The
resources of the
system.
country.
Yeah, like freeloading or whatever.
Yeah, at the same time, it was kind of like a self-preservation thing. People were not fully aware of the consequences of AIDS. Like they thought they would soon find a cure. And at a moment where, well, many freakies
Oh, you mean
were.
the ones that did it thought, not all of them thought of that they were like kind of giving themselves a death sentence.
Yeah, not all of them were thinking that they were going to die. Some of
Yeah.
them were like, okay, either live. They all lived in very precarious situations, and this preceded the special period, but of course became worse with the special period. Most of them came from lower socioeconomic status families, and many of them had also been like estranged from their families because they didn't accept them. So their lifestyle was not highly regarded. So many of them lived on the streets and stuff. So before and after the special period, their life circumstances were pretty bad. So having access to a place to stay, two or three meals a
Meals a
day and
day.
stuff, it felt you didn't have to go do the military service if you had AIDS, which
Yeah,
was also,
right.
and it was a big deal for freakies as well. Like they were really
Sure.
against the military and stuff. So all of these things combined, it seemed like a good deal, but obviously it didn't pay off. Because by the early 2000s, most of the freakies that had self-injected had died.
Yeah.
But the thing is that all of this, first, like, it creates strong bonds between the freaky community. And many of them that were living in the sanatoriums, they started to create their own bands. And many of the first punk bands emerged in sanatoriums, or at least like some of the most influential ones, which would be HIV, well, VIH, which is obviously the HIV acronym, but
Right.
they gave it a new meaning. It was instead of virus de inmunodeficiencia adquirida, eran vagos inmunes hospitalizados. So they
Could you
appropriate
just
this.
translate that? How do you
Yeah,
translate that in your
it was like
work, just for the people who don't speak
yeah,
Spanish?
I translated it as hospitalized immune vagrants. That's how I translated it, trying to make it mimic also the same letters. They were appropriating this characteristic that they were considered parasites of society, and they kind of like made a name for themselves out of that.
Right, yeah.
And definitely the freaky and the punk community have done this a lot in Cuba. And HIV is one of my favorite punk bands, but I did not choose to bring a song by them because the only recording I have is so bad quality that I cannot tell you how many hours I spent listening to the songs trying to understand what the lyrics said. It's just a very poor quality recording, unfortunately, which because it is what they had. And
And these types of groups are not, they're not getting any like EGREM, they're not getting any time in the EGREM studios, like in the national recording studios.
No, they definitely, everything was DIY, do it yourself. No? So they definitely were a very, very crucial band for the punk movement. But I did choose a song by another very important band, which was also created at a sanatorium, which is Escoria. And
that's perfect.
Another appropriation of a negative term, right? And Escoria was used for people who actually left the island, but they are appropriating this term because they are treated like they are escorias, even if they are living in Cuba because of their liking of foreign cultural
Yeah.
influences.
And escoria basically is like scum.
Yeah.
And Fidel like literally used that term to refer to, I think probably first with the Marielitos.
Yes.
And then, like, I don't know, I hear stories about like people coming out, like when the Marielitos are going to the boats and they're just, like shouting escoria and gusano at the people who, were leaving. So yeah, I can see how that way of just sort of like, okay, you're gonna call us Escoria, we're gonna adopt that name.
I forgot to say that VIH were from Havana, from a sanatorium near Havana, Los Cocos, and
Was that the one out near the San Lazaro Church out there or no?
it is in Santiago de Las Vegas, and I my geography is not good enough. I cannot tell you if it is nearby that or not, but it is close to Havana, and they are considered a Havana band.
Anyway, la iglesia que está dedicado a San Lázaro. It's where everyone goes on el Día de San Lázaro, like they go walking there, right? El Rincón. So, that's the one where everyone goes and on December 17th, el Día de San Lázaro. So, I believe they're the sanatorium or whatever where they put HIV positive patients was out there.
Okay.
Which is actually interesting because San Lázaro, of course, is the saint and the orisha like associated with disease. I mean, he was
Yeah.
leper, right? He had leprosy.
Even if they didn't want to associate with religious matters, they thought that maybe a little extra help wouldn't hurt. But yeah, so that was for HIV, and Escoria is from what was born in Santa Clara.
Oh, okay.
And to this day, I would say that Santa Clara is the punk city in Cuba.
Interesting. Okay, I didn't know that. I don't know why I assumed that it was really more associated with Havana.
In its pioneering years, Havana had a bigger impact because, well, it was easier to receive the musical
Yeah, the
influences or to get
cassettes,
the
yeah.
tapes and everything. So many of the pioneering bands were from Havana, HIV, but also other bands that were not born in the sanatorium, like Rotura and Detenidos. They were all from Havana. And there have been like punk bands in Havana for a while, but I would say that the more consolidated scene is in Santa Clara. And Havana is big and it's kind of like more separated. And there's also bigger metal scene in Havana. Santa Clara, everything is more cohesive. Everyone is more together. And punk was very
Sure.
big because Escoria was from there. And the thing is that Escoria, the leader of Escoria, William Fabian, died in 2010. So the band was active from 1993, 94 until 2010. So they had a long time to make an influence on people. HIV, for example, on the other hand, their members died of HIV. Well, the singer Amaury Triana, El Chile, he died in 1999, I believe. So as you can see, it's a shorter period of time.
Yeah.
And the other bands, Rotura and Detenidos, their lead singers left the island during the 90s. So there's also it was a shorter time span to make an influence. But on the other hand, Escoria, they were almost 3 decades? Well, no, 2 decades, 90s, 2000s. I got lost. Two
Yeah.
decades, but it's still
Yeah.
a big, yeah. And William Fabian had AIDS, but he didn't die of AIDS. He was assassinated. He was killed after a
Oh,
concert.
in
So
Cuba or
in
no?
Santa Clara.
Oh, in Santa Clara.
So everything added to this kind of like urban legend. Yeah, it created a legend around his figure and around the band. And not to say he wasn't a legend before he died, but all the circumstances surrounding his death just made it all the bigger.
Yeah.
And every year they play like a homage show in the Mejunje bar at Santa Clara, it honoring William Fabian and stuff.
Should we get to our first musical example?
Sure, the first musical example is actually Rotura, and I chose it because they were actually the first ones to record a punk record.
Got it. Okay.
Jodidos y Perdidos. Escoria came a little bit later, and actually the recording I chose was from I think the second album they recorded. So it was recorded more in the 2000s, but it's still the same members from the old school. So those two would be the first wave of punk representatives that I brought.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, tell us a little bit about the sounds.
I think it is something you have to experience, but it is, well, if you've listened to punk, it
Sure.
very much sounds like punk. It sounds amateur, it sounds like garage-y, and it sounds, there's like existential angst and anger
Yeah.
in these tracks,
Yes.
especially in the one made by Rotura. It's Jodidos y Perdidos, which
Oh, okay.
means fucked and lost.
Yeah.
And it kind of summarizes very well the feeling in that moment. It was recorded in 1991 or 1992. So
Oof.
it was at the onset of the special period. And
Yeah.
it just, yeah, the song just like, it's kind of like shouts like, ah, what am I going to do? And it takes you through this trip of emotions with them.
Okay, so Jodidos y Perdidos. You know, I don't know. I can't really think of like a better way of expressing like the desperation and angst of that period, right?
Yeah,
And that's not, I mean, obviously there was, you know, at the same time there's like timba is going on, and I just think, well, they're just going about it in a completely different way, you know?
they were very explicit in what they wanted to say, and they just it is definitely more, yeah, it's more existential anguish and anger than other expressive outlets.
Yeah. So do you want to go to the next musical example?
Yeah, sure. So this one is indeed an example from Escoria. The song I chose is Eres Tú, which is not kind of like breaks a little bit with the topic of the lyrics of Jodidos y Perdidos. It is more a song dedicated to someone. But I chose it because it is super famous in Cuba. Everyone in the punk
Mm.
scene knows it. Bands cover it all the time. And it's kind of like a little anthem for people, trying to cheer them up or help people hang in there when they are going through a tough time.
And what year is this song from?
Well, I don't know when it was first created, but it was recorded on the second album they recorded, which was in 2002.
Cuba had already kind of started, kind of like brought itself out of the crisis
Yeah.
moment.
So
But there was also, like, I think a new economic reality that had set into place in the 90s, like with the introduction of neoliberal policies and things like tourist apartheid and I'm not sure if those were things that punk groups were talking
So
about or.
that is actually a very interesting topic that you've brought, and it is indeed important because so I should have explained that even though this record by Escoria was might have been recorded in the early 2000s, what really affects the content or the topics that the bands deal with in their songs is the moment when they were created. So their formative years is what impacts them. So even if Escoria kept recording or existing until 2010, their essence was always old school punk, special period punk. Bands that were created in the early 2000s, they will show these differences in their lyrics. But bands that were created before, no. Even so, that's why like I chose this example still as a pioneering song, even if it was recorded a little bit later, because the essence of the band stays the same unchanged until the end of their days.
Got it. Okay. All right. So we're listening to Eres Tú by
Yes.
Escoria.
Eres tú, solo tú, que le quitas peso a tu propia cruz. Para llegar al final, te preguntas tú a diario sin una respuesta ya. La lucha será eterna mientras haya un cabrón que controle o manipule con sistema religión.
I'm wondering, like, was there a particular point at which there started to be like some splintering off or
By splintering off, I don't know if I understand what you mean. Can you explain?
I just mean like sub styles. So like,
Aha.
there's like of course a period of time where like a style emerges, right? And then often what happens is I guess if it gets maybe consolidated enough, eventually, either new groups arise that are just, maybe they're like mixing other styles in, or they're just kind
Yeah.
of taking things in a different direction.
Yeah, definitely. That you can see a difference in the bands that were created in the early 2000s. Well, they get a lot of inspiration from Spanish and Latin American punk rock, and they start to be a little bit more melodic in their punk style, less desgarrado. I don't know how to say this in English. And a little bit more melodic. So because this quality of being a desgarrado was very characteristic of the first punk songs.
Yeah, I
And
don't know if I actually know that term, desgarrado. Is it like unhinged sort of thing, or
I think Unhinged has a different tone.
I'm curious, like which of the Latin American, which bands were like most influential?
I would say mostly bands from Spain and bands from Latin America. It would be maybe bands that are not famous, but maybe someone from a Latin American band traveled to Cuba and they met with the punks, and that made a huge impact on them. And so that's, they didn't, even if it was the early 2000s, they didn't have access to the internet yet in Cuba. So the way they were receiving their influences was still a little bit old school.
Sure, like there, but there
Yeah.
were probably CDs being maybe passed around by then.
Maybe they were, yeah, they were
I
burning
guess I'm
CDs, or
thinking about like, Latin American rock, the profile really like started to rise a lot like in the 90s, and then what, but I mean, I guess they were more like, they weren't punk and they weren't DIY necessarily, but I'm even thinking of like about a group that I particularly love, like Aterciopelados, like a group like that.
I would think that something like Aterciopelados or Soda Stereo, they would be more influential for people who were into trova or something like that.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and even though they could listen to some rock, but the things that would influence their music making, it would be more like 80s Spanish punk bands.
Got it.
Escorbuto was a punk band that really influenced a lot of people. More melodic and famous in Spain would be Escape. That's a like a ska punk band that was also very influential in Cuba. Those would be the examples I can think of. And
Okay.
then even though I might not know these bands or they are not that famous, that the fact that people would like either visit Cuba or maybe organize a little small concert in Cuba, those would exert a big influence on punk musicians as well.
Did you want to like talk about maybe one of those bands that started in the 2000s and maybe had like a slightly different sound?
I actually one of the songs I chose for today is from one of those bands,
Okay.
Acupunctura, and it's kind of well, the name is just like a word play with punk, that
Oh, okay.
acupunctura.
Yes.
The song is named Azul Blue, so it refers to the ocean, and it's a song about migrating, about leaving Cuba.
Okay.
So here you can see that it's obviously they've already lived through the years of the special period and are kind of like reflecting on the impact of it now. So that it is just a song about the mixed feelings and the sadness of leaving your country.
Yeah.
And it does sound much more melodic than the previous songs. Listening to it will probably be a better, people will get a better idea than me attempting to describe it. Bear in mind that it still sounds kind of homemade because people are still self-recording themselves, and they will record the voice and the instruments and stuff, but they will never be able to record drums live. They will always have like kind of like some kind of electronic drum made
Okay.
with Guitar Pro that sounds slightly artificial if you listen to it, because they don't have the resources to record actual drums.
So by this point, so they're recording themselves like in sort of like makeshift home studios on just whatever like computer equipment that they can get. Yeah, okay.
Computer or analog equipment they can get. They are very savvy when it comes to repurposing things or fixing broken equipment and stuff. I've seen,
Yeah, I mean, that's all Cubans, really.
it really is a Cuban thing, and you can really see it in the music area, and especially in a music scene that had no government sponsorship or support. They did have to make everything themselves. So they will, for example, I don't know, get instruments that a school of music had thrown out because they were damaged. They would take those and they would try to fix them. So you would have a guitar that was like a 1980s Soviet thing, and it had one part was a bass part, the other part was from a guitar, and it's just mix and match and inventando that, which is very, very Cuban, and doing their instrumentos criollos.
So we're going to listen to Azul from Acupuntura.
He cruzado el azul con la sonrisa colgada y una esperanza en los ojos. He cruzado el azul, aunque me aguarde un color más oscuro que el de antes. He cruzado el azul, no quiero que me extrañe, está echada la suerte. He dejado a mi perro vagando por las calles y a mi madre llorando. Me cansé de vivir cocinando mis deseos, calderos vacíos. He cruzado el azul, ya la suerte es echada. He cruzado el azul, no quiero que me extrañe. He cruzado el azul, he cruzado el azul, he cruzado el azul, he cruzado el azul.
Now, one question I had was the racial makeup of these groups. I'm assuming they were like mostly white, as punk groups are, I think, in most places, even, in multiracial societies. But is that true? Or, were there, black or mixed race musicians participating?
Well, it is mostly true. It is a majority white scene. There's obviously people from all races represented there, but they are a minority. And it didn't use to be like that when it was in the 80s with Frikis. At least, well, from what I've been able to see in archival photos or like old pictures that people, contacts I've met share, it seems like there were many more Black people in the Friki scene. And my theory, my untested theory, but that I believe makes sense, is that, well, in the 90s, when hip hop became a thing, just Black people in Cuba, it felt more represented by hip hop and rap, and that's what their musical scene of choice. So it kind of like caused the punk and metal scene to become more white, like the white people stayed and more white people joined, and Black and Afro descendant people decided to go with a different thing.
Yeah, or they were just doing like they were just in the timba, right?
Yeah, of
Which
course.
was of course more popular, much more popular than either of those other, even like rap cubano is definitely like a subculture in a lot of
Yeah,
ways.
that's why actually I compare rap to punk, because I
Yeah,
see that
it's
they are like
interesting.
underground music scenes
Yes.
that emerged in the 90s. So I feel like people who felt identified with hip hop, that it is likely that maybe those people were into rock or rock related cultures
Okay.
before, you know?
Yeah, I see what you mean. It's almost more like maybe sort of like a countercultural ideology. But then within that, like you see a splintering off maybe biracial identity a little bit more. Because these are, because either way, these are not going to be people who are necessarily going to be, you know, like dancing to like the most popular or, you know, thing on the radio, which is maybe like theme bar salsa, right? Yeah, I see what you mean.
Well, also punk and metal have been majority white genres worldwide. So
sure.
if the representation you see is mostly white, that's
Yeah.
probably what you're gonna get.
Yeah. No, I mean, it actually is actually really interesting to compare those two scenes in Cuba, because like they also happen to be, they were really the two genres where musicians were most explicitly critiquing the government, right?
Yeah.
Much more so than, you know, in timba, it was always had to be very veiled, or like the doble sentido thing, right? Whereas like, yeah, these were, you know, it seems to me in both punk and hip hop, musicians were like a lot more explicit.
Yeah, and I do think they have a lot of things in common. Yeah, because they are not just the music, but they are their own subculture,
Yes.
their own scene, their own community, and they share this critiques towards their regime and this contestatory attitude. So they do have a lot of things in common, but I would say that punk. But punk is privileged in a racial sense,
Sure.
like so because they, I mean, punks can also be prosecuted or like stopped by police and they received fines and whatever and they were harassed by the authorities. But looking punk is something that you can choose to wear or not to wear, whereas being black is an identity you cannot choose to take off.
Yeah.
So in that sense, like you can choose to perform or be seen as punk in certain contexts and not in
Right.
certain others. And this is actually something that a band from La Lisa, a neighborhood in Havana, they addressed this, and they were against people who would like have a casual appearance. So like, no, you need to look punk.
Oh, I see.
Because,
Like, oh, like, yes, like you can't like take this identity on or off
like you need to
depending
look
on the
punk.
situation that you're in. You
Exactly.
should just always, yeah.
You should always have this very specific, like you should always have your mohawk, you should always have your tattoos and stuff, and everything should be at this in on display at all times,
Yeah.
because this is your identity and like you cannot take it off, and
Right.
which is privileged in a way, but and to me it was a very interesting change and something very specifically Cuban, of the punk scene in Cuba, because in other areas in the US, being punk actually, like if you have the most eccentric aesthetic or the most super punk aesthetic, you are actually seen as less authentic.
You're like a poser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So having a casual look is highly regarded, but here into this group of punks from La Lisa, it is not an option.
I see. Yeah. That's interesting. And I was also about to say, like, when you're talking about the 90s, like, you know, and you're talking about like sort of the privilege of being able to take on or off this, you know, identity. And then you also have to consider like the entry of tourism and the ways that Black people were racially profiled, like basically like the beginning of this racial profiling, right, of Black people
Totally.
in public spaces, especially if they're walking around with, you know, white foreigners, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as a personal anecdote, when I've been to Cuba, I've never been stopped by police when I've been hanging out with punk friends. But when I've been hanging out with Black friends, I have been stopped on a couple of
Yeah,
occasions,
so have
and
I.
they have been So the level of discrimination is definitely not the same.
Yeah. Okay. What's our next example?
So, well, actually, it's very fitting because I brought a song by Staphylococcus, and they are a punk band from La Lisa.
Okay.
They created their own like sub scene named Punk Radical Cubano, like Cuban radical punk, which is inspired by Rock Radical Vasco, which was in Spain, in northern Spain in the 80s, and it was a like a punk hub in northern
In
Spain.
the País Vasco, in the Basque
Yes.
Country, yeah.
And Eskorbuto, which is what this influential band I mentioned before, they are like their idols, and the name Staphylococcus is kind of like a homage to Eskorbuto. Eskorbuto is it's an illness that I don't know how to say in English. It's the illness that people would get at sea because of lack of
Okay.
vitamin C.
Oh, scurvy, I think.
Yes, scurvy, that is.
Like centuries ago and stuff.
Yes, centuries ago. Yes, scurvy. Actually, it's very similar. Eskorbuto, scurvy,
Okay.
and they chose like another a virus or a bacteria, Staphylococcus, and that's
Okay.
their name.
Okay.
And it's one of the few bands where a female participates. They have two singers, and one of them is a woman,
Okay.
La Negra. And their song is "Esta no es mi puta guerra." This is not my fucking war, and it's against the mandatory military service.
Okay. And stylistically, is this like pretty hardcore or?
It is actually this would belong to songs. These are bands created after 2010, and that
Okay.
would be a new age for punk in Cuba, in my
Yeah.
opinion. So one would be the 90s, the other the early 2000s, now 2010 and beyond. And they start to receive other influences, and their punk starts to change. This
Yeah.
would be more of a punk oi song. Oi is like oi is the music that skinheads will play. Skinheads, not necessarily Nazi skinheads, usually like
Okay.
communist skinheads and stuff.
Like anarchists.
Yeah, communists.
Okay.
They are obviously no punks in Cuba are communists, but they are
Oh, right.
many of them are anarchists.
Okay.
So, but this is a punk oi style kind of song.
Okay.
Attention!
Tell me where you want to go next.
Well, I think we're already after the 2010s. We could try to bring it to a close and see how the scene has been going in the like this last stage, which is at least the last stage I analyzed. I would dare to say it might be the last stage.
Oh.
We can discuss this in a few minutes, but so this. Like after 2010, there's a new generation of musicians that have been born after the special period was over.
Right.
Like they have been born in the late 90s and even early 2000s. So they are very young. They're a completely new generation. And they've already grown with Cuban punk as an influence. So like the early punks would receive foreign influences, but these
right.
punks have already been influenced by Escoria, by BIH. So it is more of a fully 100% national product, you
okay.
know?
Okay.
At the same time, this is a time in which internet access starts to become a thing.
Yeah.
The scene kind of like restructures itself. It stops being such an enclosed national or local scene, and they start to create transnational networks. And they get in touch with punks from other areas. And I would say this would reach its peak during the pandemic, where like everything was stopped and everything was happening online. So many people actually participated in like online music festivals that people organized.
Yeah.
And Cuban punk bands would usually pre-record themselves and send the recording because they couldn't trust doing it live, but
sure.
they still participated in a way. And these bands have a more, their lyrics are combative in a way. So they are still critiquing the system and complaining about things. The song we just listened to, the Esta No Es Mi Puta Guerra, is very overtly critiquing things of the regime they don't like.
Sure.
They actually, in one part of the lyrics, they said, everything is your fault, Fidel. Yeah, fucking Fidel.
So totally turning totally against the narrative of the embargo, which is what Cubans just are constantly, indoctrinated with. It's the embargo, the embargo, the embargo.
Yeah, and some people can understand the effects of the embargo, but they
yes.
definitely are very highly critical of the regime. And
yeah.
They also, well, they belong into punk. They've seen cultural oppression happening. So they are, I haven't met a single punk that is supportive of the Cuban government.
Yeah.
In Cuba, outside of Cuba, there's a lot. And sometimes
yeah.
that leads to frictions.
When people,
punks from other areas, from Spain or from the US, they usually have this idea.
Oh, you're not. You're talking about not Cubans.
Not Cubans. Yeah.
That's
oh,
Cuba, oh, no, 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 no. Yeah. Oh,
Cubans,
yeah. No,
yeah.
That. No, that is totally. Yes.
Yeah.
No,
no,
I mean,
not
like, I essentially like, you know, I don't know, like random leftists who think they know things, they know nothing and they should just shut the fuck up, basically. I'm so tired of like people who've never been there and who have no idea what it's like talking about
Cuba. It is unfair because they are not open to dialogue and they just see Cuba as like an idea.
It's a cipher.
Yeah, and an idea that kind of like supports their ideology.
Their ideology.
And they don't see it as a place where people live.
No.
Which is in itself like a very colonialist way of looking at it. But let's go back to Cuban punk. And,
yes. Okay, yeah.
So I was saying that the lyrics are very combative, but they don't have the anguish of the earlier punk. They have a kind of like more positive look on life, if you will. Not that it's super positive, but 90s punk is very no future kind of
yeah,
punk.
Very, really, very like dystopian and dark. And
yeah, they really believe there are no alternatives. And
yeah.
Like they're like, what happens when you want to destroy what you hate, knowing that you will not be able to build anything new? That's what's going on in the 90s. And
yeah,
here they received other input and they've lived a different era, and they do believe another future is possible. So they still dislike what they have, but they do.
In Cuba or only by leaving Cuba?
That is,
because that's a big question, right?
It is a difficult question to answer. I would like to say that many people would like to think that a different future in Cuba is possible, but most of the punks I met have left the island in recent years. It's just, that's why a little bit ago I was saying that maybe this was the last stage of punk and there will not be a new one, because I don't know if there will be a scene left, at least a nationally localized scene, I think we should start looking at different things, as at how these transnational networks of punk work with Cuban influence, and how Cuban punks who have left have started projects abroad, and how they stay in touch with the island and stuff.
Yeah.
That I think that would be the way to look at it now. Most of mm-hmm. the bands have Estafilococo, which we played before, has left. But the last example I brought, which is a band I love very much, they're great people. I love them personally. They're Pólvora Social, and they are still in Cuba. They are still in Cuba. So maybe they are the future. Maybe they are the future of Cuban punk. Yeah, and their song has more of a hardcore punk sound. And the one I chose is named Ruido en el Sistema, Noise in the System. Mm-hmm. And it talks a little bit about their identity as punks of the new school. About a little bit about punk identity and finding strength in punk.
Okay.
Ruido en el sistema, sangre, hierve mis venas, no. No somos de la vieja escuela. Ya no hay razón para parar. Seguiré mientras pueda. Sistema, sangre, quemando nuestras venas, no, no somos de la vieja escuela, ya no hay razón para parar, seguiré mientras pueda, ruido en el sistema, sangre, hierve mis venas, no, la música ha sido mi escuela, ya no hay razón para parar, seguiré mientras pueda.
I mean, obviously, you know, the amount of out migration from Cuba in the past, like 2 or 3 years, has been really enormous. And for people who don't know, it's like the numbers are like over 400,000. It's something like 4% of the island's population, 4 to 5%. It's a really big number. And it's the largest, I don't know, I would kind of venture to say maybe like the largest out migration ever, in the sense that, you know, even during the colonial time, I don't know that you would have like seen this much out migration. And certainly since the revolution, like, you know, it's much bigger than any of the other waves.
Yeah. And it's not just because, well, the situation is obviously, very extreme, and people are experiencing like a lot of scarcity, to put it in a nice way, and that's obviously the main reason why people are leaving. But also, like, so many people have left that they feel like, I have no one left here, so why would I stay? Mm-hmm. So everyone else like also wants to go, you know, because they have no community left.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Carmen, for coming on, and I really hope people enjoyed this episode, which was like such a big departure sonically, more than anything.
Thank you.
I learned a lot.
Well, I hope people have found it interesting. I definitely think, I'm very passionate about this topic. I wrote a dissertation about it, and I wanted to thank you, Rebecca, and I wanted to thank all the Cuban punks that helped me with this research, that allowed me to listen to their music, that told me their stories, that invited me to their houses. It's just like, it wouldn't have been possible without them, and I'm forever indebted to them. So thank you.
Yeah. And just one note, if you want to know more, I believe Carmen curated a website called punkcubano.net.
Yes.
And I believe it has like a lot more information there, right?
It definitely has a lot more music. You can find the bands on a little map, or you can search through the directory
Cool.
of bands. So you can find more bands, you can listen to more music, and there's a little text. But if you've listened to the podcast, I don't think the text is going to tell you anything new.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
And just a reminder, if you'd like to support the show, please click on support the show in the episode notes. Any donations are very welcome and help me to continue doing this work. I will see you next time.